From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. What is the condition of secondary education in the United States? What should it be? To answer those questions, the National Humanities Center brought together a group of scholars and writers, and Soundings now presents the first part of their discussion. The speakers are Gilbert Sewell, Dennis Doyle, Donald Steadman, Joseph Adelson, and Carl Dulcie. Gilbert Sewell was education editor at Newsweek magazine. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book on educational reform. Dennis Doyle is director of education policies studies at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Donald Steadman is associate vice president for academic affairs at the University of North Carolina. Joseph Adelson is director of the psychological clinic at the University of Michigan. And Carl Dulcie is Dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. Here is Gilbert Sewell.
In the last year, education publicists have told us to emphasize the good news. In the same 12 months, I visited about 30 schools in 8 states around the country, and I have seen a lot of bad things in districts, affluent and poor. What I see across the country in junior high schools, senior high schools, are frayed adult-child relations, shoddy curricular content, misguided public policy, lack of behavioral norms, lack of institutional coherence and purpose. The question arises, are American schools producing a generation of able alphas and bewildered deltas for the late 20th century? There is good news, and that's the broad-gauged rejection of schools as social redeemers and great equalizers. A new sense, a new conviction that schools can make a difference, and an important difference. There is, across the country, in many, many quarters, a renewed interest in quality, and a real sense of urgency creating effective, purposeful schools. A sense that the nation is depleting its human capital, a point that Dennis Doyle has made most persuasively. Now, how might schools assist human capital formation?
Well, they can assist in some very dramatic and obvious ways. Certainly vocational and technical training come quickly to mind. But in more subtle and important ways, they can assist in developing the capacity to reason, to analyze, to master the generative skills, those set of skills which lay the foundation for analytic and technical thinking in a highly complex modern world. In many jurisdictions, the high schools are not thought of as the instrument of human capital formation because they're thought of as places where general education is acquired, California being, I think, the principal example in which vocational and technical and professional and other forms of human capital education usually take place at the post-secondary level. But for many years in our society, we had vocational and technical schools. When I was growing up in Chicago, we had a couple of huge technical schools, which were devoted quite self-consciously and explicitly to preparing people for work and to increase their productive potential.
Dennis, I think I understand the notion, the human capital notion, but one of the things that concerns me a little bit when I think about problems that secondary education has is that increasingly in many states, particularly in the southern region, there's an attempt by legislative or executive branches to put leverage on curriculum in order to harness public education for economic development in the state, which is okay, I suppose, in some sense. But what worries me is the notion that that kind of force linked to the human capital notion could have more leverage on curriculum really than the testing business, which everybody seems to be very worried about. And play on that a little bit.
Well, I would share your concern. Certainly at a general level, I think it's important for schools to retain some sense of their principal mission, which at least I think through 12th grade is a broad general education in the liberal tradition of education, the better sense of that, and that schools should not become engines of democratic capitalism, simply producing a docile and tractable workforce. But I do think it's important for schools to let kids know how important it is to prepare themselves for work, for later life. And there are many ways for them to acquire human capital after secondary schooling. We've seen a burgeoning growth in the private sector, business and industry, and even labor unions, now devoting very substantial resources to human capital formation. Our best estimates at AEI are that about $30 billion a year now is being invested by business and industry in what could be generally called human capital formation. And that number is just about half the amount now being spent by all of our public and private universities and colleges for undergraduate and advanced training. So that there seems to me to be clearly an increasing awareness on the part of employers and students as well, the necessity to forge ahead in this area.
Kind of a supply-side education.
Yes, as it were.
Joe?
I was very struck, Gil, by your comment on the able alphas and the, I forget what you call the deltas.
Bewildered
deltas.
Yeah.
Because that corresponds very much to my own impression about what's happening in our school system. My observations, I was very captured by that there seems to be an increasingly a cleavage between youngsters who, you know what they want to become, have, you know, a strong sense of themselves and of their careers and what have you, and a great many youngsters who seem to be a bit aimless, more than a bit aimless.
Anomic,
yes. And hedonic, too.
Now, what does that mean, Joe?
Well, you know, they're sort of going along, and what will be will be. And I think you see an awful lot of that. Now, you've always seen that. I think one has to resist the temptation to, you know, to a sort of nostalgia for, you know, how terrific things were back in the old days. But I really do think there's a change. You know, we have enough data to know that increasing numbers of the young are involved in social pathology. There's been a huge increase in crime, illegitimate pregnancy, suicide, you name it, almost any indication you want of social pathology has increased among the young, and only among the young, by the way. Over the last two decades. Now, the reasons for this are obscure, though I'm willing to venture a few notions. But the fact is that if you have a 2 to 3 times rise in percentage, and not merely numbers, that indicates that, you know, that it's not merely the children who are involved in that, but their fallout, so to speak, on other children. And I think there's a... I sense that. I mean, you sense that in any high school.
Yes.
Are you talking about the cities primarily? Is this
No, I think you see it more suburban than urban.
Absolutely. Yes, especially from homes, from families that very well may have risen to their economic security through success, earlier success in school.
Do kids learn more in school or out of school? I suppose that's an awfully simple question.
Well, that's an important question, though. One that is probably impossible to answer, but nevertheless useful to speculate about. The things they learn in school at least should be the things they can't learn outside school. A kid can't sit out on a bench and speculate about geometry and invent Euclidean theorem, so I suppose some children could, but not very many. So that the kinds of things that schools are able to teach are precisely the things that schools should do, and those are the things that kids should be able to learn best in schools. But in terms of the larger set of skills that a person needs to survive in the modern world, they clearly learn an enormous amount outside of school, from peers, from family, from television, from a very wide variety of sources.
Gil?
Dewey made the point very early on that in everyday life, learning is incidental, that in schools learning is intentional, that schools are the agencies in a complicated culture that have an explicit task to transmit skills that are basic, are necessary skills that a student can use to build and thus engage in incidental learning more efficiently.
Well, that leads to a question. Let me put this to Carl and Don. From your standpoint as educators, what are these basic skills? What is this general education that Dennis Doyle mentioned that kids are supposed to have by the time they get to the universities, by the time they finished grades 1 through 12? Carl?
That's kind of a tall order, because you can begin at the most primitive level, and that is the ability to read and to write and to perform arithmetic functions. And for many people, it stops there, but of course, that's not nearly enough in today's society. We're talking about, and I'll go back to a term that Dennis used. It's a term that I've been fascinated with. Used very eloquently by Clifton Fadiman when he developed the concept of generative knowledge. And by generative knowledge is meant that knowledge which is essential to learning all subsequent knowledge. And that's a sort of a conceptual tool for separating out trivial knowledge versus more basic. And I think when we talk about basic things that are important to people in today's society, we're talking about scientific literacy, we're talking about a grounding in the humanities and in the social sciences. We're talking about the ability to think and to conceptualize, and incidentally, the ability to abstract and conceptualize seems to be a particularly difficult spot in the high school curriculum. The National Assessment, for example, points out that there's been a decline in the percentage of children and young people taking the test who are able to engage in interpretation of that which is read, as differentiated from direct comprehension and literal interpretation. So my answer to that is that the kinds of things that the high school should be about are those intellectual skills which are essential for further learning and which make for a well-educated person in today's society. And as I indicated, the whole concept of an educated person, I think, has to undergo metamorphosis. We know that it is. For example, literacy around the turn of the century, if we talk about basic literacy on the primitive level, was significantly less than basic literacy today to function in today's society. Certainly the need to come to grips with science and technology and the human questions involved in the use of science and technology and those value questions are terribly important and were not even thought about around the turn of the century. And so as our society becomes more complex, the demands on general education also increase. I just might make one other observation, and that is if one talks about vocational and technical education and the importance of those aspects in development of human capital, I think it's essential to remember that these aspects of education must be built on the basic foundation of an adequate education. And no technical skill development can really take place in today's society unless it is built on the foundation of a more general education. And so I see that those concerns about human capital development necessarily including the general education component, the education of students.
I think we have to be careful not to overfocus on just the cognitive aspects of a secondary school. There's a lot going on in that developmental stage of young people that is reflected in the secondary school curriculum, in the behavior of teachers, in the way in which administrators respond, and in fact triggers a lot of what we have identified as troublesome aspects of the secondary experience. And aside from the importance of continuing to sharpen the basics, I think we have to continue to explore what it means, what we mean by motivation, and what the value and belief system formations are. The developmental task of a young person in the secondary schools is to figure out who he or she is. And they use adults in that system, as well as the as their family, to try to parcel that out. Now, that, you know, that's not pop psych. I think that's probably our best estimate of where people are in that developmental stage. Well, what does that mean? It means that you have to take into account more than just the cognitive elements when you talk about curriculum in the high school, just as you do in the preschool. You know, we talk about the preschool curriculum being family and values and so forth. Young people confront one another and in a more diverse way, and more diverse people and ideas in the secondary, the way we're structured. And adolescence is a melting, you know, is a real bubbly thing to start with, and you add that to that racial tensions and confronting adult values and confronting many of the authoritarian features of the way in which we've structured schools, and you've got a ready-made scenario for not learning much. And I think we really have to attend to that aspect of it. We really haven't done it well.
Donna, I think that sometimes it's a matter of how one chooses to go about achieving certain things. We went through a whole era of direct focus on human relations and T groups and human relations and so forth and so on. The results of those efforts have not been very promising because they focused directly on an affective byproduct. I think our experience is indicating that people develop good human relationships when they are task-oriented and they have to achieve certain things, and the human relations are a spin-off, they're a byproduct of another more fundamental process. I say that by way of talking about the whole matter of the non-cognitive. It depends on how one chooses to go about it.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not proposing encounter groups at all. I'm with you on that. What I am saying is that competence includes social competence, and that's an element we haven't paid enough attention to, I think.
Right, but I think the point that I'm making is not on, you know, T groups or that sort of thing, but to say that one can develop one's aesthetic sense, okay, in the study of art. The aesthetic experience is a byproduct of that study. One can develop an aesthetic sense in the study of literature. One can develop a sense of quality and of standards, not by focusing on quality and standards, but by focusing on things which need to be achieved. So I just think that we do engage in a fundamental error when we say that the school should focus on certain non-cognitive aspects apart from the fundamental task of the schools.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part one in a series of discussions on the status and aims of secondary education in America. The speakers in this portion of the discussion are Gilbert Sewell, Donald Stedman, Dennis Doyle, and Carl Dolce. Gilbert Sewell was education editor at Newsweek magazine. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book on educational reform. Donald Stedman is associate vice president for academic affairs at the University of North Carolina. Dennis Doyle is director of education policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Carl Dolce is dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. The conversation turns now to academic standards in American secondary schools. Here is Gilbert Sewell.
Who sets educational standards in the country today? My short answer would be, in too many cases, the students themselves. That students determine how hard they will work, how much pressure they will tolerate, that it is the student who decides whether he or she will strive or not strive.
Is that because the teachers have abdicated the responsibility, or have the students stolen it? What have the parents done? Stood by and watched this happen, assuming that the charge is true? Don, can you comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure what it is. One element that I think I detect is that too many teachers and administrators are simply afraid of what would happen if they tried to organize or set up any specific activities. Instead, they've kind of would rather kind of carry out the democratic process and make sure that that people don't get angry, and it makes for a happy ship. Now, that's pretty glib, you know, but there's a greater sensitivity, especially as litigation becomes a more popular tool from parents and everybody else, to be careful to avoid. It's really more a shift of kind of locus of control. It's an attempt to avoid failure rather than to put success in place, and the instrumentality of teachers and administrators, it appears to me, has fallen back. And that's not just a matter of the structure of the secondary school. I also see that in some teacher education or educational administration training programs, where there's built into that, a tendency to overreact to the possible negative outcomes of trying to organize or a school or a or impose, if you will, or put in place a curriculum. Now, certainly that's probably debatable, but that seems to be one element that leads to Gill's notion about kids being one of the major sources, if not the major source, of setting standards in secondary schools.
Another source of standards, of course, is the state legislature today. One of the most interesting phenomena of the 1970s was a spontaneous grassroots movement, a national movement that bypassed the federal government and the national education associations, a movement for competency testing of students and in some cases of teachers, a competency testing movement that has now been put in force in some 40 states.
That was a very interesting development. You're quite right. And the linchpin, or this, at least the symbolic linchpin, was that in 1980, for the first time in our history, more than half of school revenues were generated at the state level by state legislatures. Historically, local control has meant local generation of revenues, and that process has been changing gradually throughout the 20th century. And in some states, California being the most notable example, about 80% of state school expenditures are provided by Sacramento, and the remaining 20% is provided by a statutory formula enacted in Sacramento, so that one can assert that at least in some sense, California is becoming a statewide school system. And it's no accident that the California legislature has been the most interventionist and most activist in education, and what you describe, I think, is part of a long-term set of trends nationally.
By that, do you mean we're paying for it? We want something to come of it?
Precisely. There is no necessary relationship between those two activities, but historically, in this country at least, there has been a well-developed notion that he who pays the piper calls the tune. If the state legislature is paying the freight, they expect to set the standards, and they have done so with some very damaging effects. California, again, is a perfect example. Two-part series in the Los Angeles Times recently by Bill Trombley, a very distinguished education writer, in which he describes the dumbing of America, the progression over the past decade of writing down textbooks so that he can assert, and other experts assert with, I think, complete confidence, that both post-secondary and secondary textbooks have decreased in difficulty on the order of 2 years over the past 10 or 12 years, so that simply reading textbooks for content side by side demonstrates a very dramatic decline in the degree of difficulty of textbooks, and as a complicated set of circumstances that have led to that, the failure of school boards to exercise leadership, the failure of the Curriculum Commission in California to undertake rigorous adoption proceedings, the willingness of the textbook giants to pander to a market which is steadily sinking.
Pander or stay in business.
Or to stay in business, sinking to a lower common denominator. And California is especially important example because it enrolls about 12% of the nation's young people in elementary and secondary school. Is the single biggest textbook market in the world. And what California does, of course, always seems to set the pace for the rest of the nation. But in this particular example, it's particularly important.
How much do the standards vary?
If we include the whole of elementary and secondary education, the answer is yes, they are widely various. And by the whole, I would think to include selective public high schools such as Bronx School of Science, the fine academic preparatory private schools, and then non-selective but very high quality public schools such as Beverly Hills or New Trier, areas that I'm familiar with, or Newton High. Those are schools which have maintained what we would think of as traditional high standards, rigorous academic programs. They require a distribution of study. They would offer a wide range of advanced placement courses. The full panoply of what most people would regard as a first-rate academic program. And then the other end of the scale, of course, is a unfortunately large group of schools which have very low standards indeed.
Yeah, my feeling is that with regard to the minimum standards, if you watch the history of the development of these competency tests, for example, they tend to be very much like one another. In fact, states copy one another. They find, you know, similar ways to go about developing the test and producing it and trying to take cost into account and a bank of extra items and all that business. And that tends to produce fairly uniform minimum standards across the nation. On the high side, though, on the achievement side or the high standards side, there's a tendency to be two groups. One, the secondary school systems that have the money and the student population that's mostly a college-bound population, as opposed to the poorer schools or those populated mostly by young people who are not achieving or not striving or moving more toward not moving toward a post-high school experience, or indeed even increasingly dropping out before the end of the high school period.
We all know historically that standards have varied widely, and the variation transcends school systems. I think most of us can recollect in our own school days the one teacher who had an extremely high set of expectations and standards, and the teacher next door teaching perhaps the same course with a quite a different set of expectations and standards. So I think that Don's right. If you go beyond the minimal level, there is a wide range of expectations. And part of the problem, I think, is that there are fewer of us who have a vision of what can be accomplished. And so if one has a low set of expectations, that inevitably results in a low set of standards, and therefore a lessened drive to stimulate students to achieve.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for Soundings with part one of the Center's series on American secondary education. My guests include the former education editor at Newsweek magazine, the associate vice president for academic affairs at the University of North Carolina, the Director of Education Policies Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, the Director of the Psychological Clinic at the University of Michigan, and the Dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. What's the condition of secondary education in America? What should it be? Listen for answers and insights. That's part one of American Secondary Education, this week on Soundings.